Welcome to the Big C podcast series, an initiative of Algoa FM's Big Walk for Cancer. I'm Caroline Kelleher, and in this episode, we are talking research and innovation and the future of cancer treatment. And with me to unpack this interesting topic are directors from Phoenix Pharma, Dr. Neil Milan, and Dr. Zelda Pint. Thank you so much for joining us and for bringing your expertise to the table. Can I call you Zelda and Neil?
Please.
Oh, thank you so much. Right. This is a discussion for the layman. So, doctors, I want to ask you, what is it that Phoenix Pharma does? We understand we have a broad idea of research, obviously, but what is it that you do as a research company? What is your specific area of cancer research and any current projects that you are working on?
We are a private research facility, which means we conduct the clinical research on behalf of pharmaceutical companies. It's important to note that we don't specialize specifically in cancer research, but also cancer, but all sorts of disease entities that we feel we will be able to recruit participants for a study and benefit the participants. In this regard, we've done recent skin cancer studies. We've done a squamous cell carcinoma study, actually two, one with an intravenous administration and one with a capsule formulation of the same class of drug. And at the moment, we're busy with a melanoma study. And there's, in the near future, a blood cancer myeloma study that's to follow.
Okay, can we talk about the melanoma study? Am I correct in saying that is one of the more common cancers among men?
Yes, melanoma is a common cancer, especially in South Africa with the sun. It's cancer that we see often. And the latest treatment regimens in the past couple of years have proved very successful. So it's an area of research and development that's actually become quite a hot topic because of the success rate. As well as, and now I think we'll speak about it later, the latest innovations that's come through is also now starting to come off patent, which is going to mean that it's going to be much more accessible for a larger part of the community than what it was previously, which is actually very, very good news.
What makes the cancer treatments so expensive? You hear stories of the latest research bringing out a drug that has had amazing results, but it's so expensive.
Yeah.
What is it? Is it?
Unfortunately, the development of drugs is extremely expensive. It's actually a complete topic of its own. But if you look at cancer research at the moment, to develop a cancer drug, you're looking at upwards of $5 billion to get a drug to market.
Yeah.
And obviously that costs need to be recovered somewhere. Medication can only be effective if patient can afford to take it.
Yes.
So that is a big problem, and there's a multidisciplinary reasons why this is so expensive. But basically, it comes down to regulation. We have two rules and two rules only when it comes to research, and that is the safety of the patient is paramount, and the clean data.
Yeah.
And it's to regulate and police those two rules that makes the whole process so expensive.
So, is there an average of, okay, you've proven that this drug is effective and it works, we want to take it to market. How long does that take?
It can take in excess of 10 years.
Wow.
Research goes through in humans. That follows after animal research. Typically goes through four stages. Stage one is only safety. You must determine if it's safe for humans to take it, irrespective of what animal studies show. And that's a slow process. In the past, it used to be that we could administer a phase one study drug to a number of participants at the same time. But now, because of incidents and that happened in the past, it's one patient at a time worldwide. Okay. It's on average 30 to 60 participants in the phase one study, small numbers, and all the data of a patient need to be analyzed before the next patient is placed on the study. That takes 2 to 4 weeks per patient to get the data analyzed, and then the next patient is administered the drug. So it takes 18 months to 2 years for a phase one study to be completed. And then phase two is a dose finding study where we want to know is 100 milligram, 200 milligram, or 500 milligram the ideal dose to carry on with. That takes another 2 to 5 years. And then phase three studies is the first time that we use this new compound for the disease that it's being developed for. And that can take anything from 3 years to 10 years. In terms of cancer research, before I get to the phase four studies, it's important to know that we need long-term follow-up data. It's not good enough to say that patients can do more physical activities after receiving the chemotherapy or the new drug. I say chemotherapy, but actually all new medication. You need to know that in the long term, it saves lives, and it is an improvement of what is available at the moment, also long-term side effects. So that is followed up for long periods of time, sometimes until a patient dies or there's definite disease progression. And then coming back to phase four clinical studies, these are normally done at the request of a regulatory authority. After phase three studies, if it's proven successful, the drug can be placed on the market. But sometimes the regulatory authority will say, you've now launched a new cholesterol medication. We know up to this point, cholesterol medications give muscle aches. But you haven't mentioned anything about muscle aches. Do a study for 2 years and focus on muscle aches and report back.
Oh, okay.
So, but that's after a drug has been placed on the market.
What would you say are some of the biggest unanswered questions in cancer research right now?
So there are quite a couple of unanswered questions. And the more we know, the more questions we tend to get. We're trying to distinguish why cancer cells develop. Mm. Why do they mutate? Why are they? Why some people get cancer, other people don't get cancer? In certain animal groups, you don't find cancer, although they're long-living specimens. Things like the area around the cancer, the specific environment around the cancer that develops, is it specific to certain kinds of cancers? Are they all the same? We're finding that if you look over the last 50 years and you look at the change in incidence in cancers, now we know that the world is having an aging population, and obviously we do know that older people are tend to get cancer more frequently than younger people. So that is obviously one of the reasons. But there are also a quite a big uptick in incidence in your younger than 50 population.
Yes, I seem to know so many people who are young. A neighbor of mine, a niece, 27, and it is terminal cancer.
Yes, and it's also the type of cancers. Cancers that used to be very, very rare a couple of years ago, we are seeing more frequently.
More of them.
And so those are the questions we're asking, why? And we also want to find out why. Is it the lifestyle? Is it the environmental changes that we having to live through? Does that cause it? There's a whole new science or pattern of thought into epigenetics. Now, epigenetics is on top of genetics. So that means your DNA stays the same, yet the environmental factors that influences your body causes your function of that DNA to change. It's a very interesting way of doing it, but basically the body, these tiny little carbon and hydrogen groups that go and sit on the DNA. And DNA, the only thing that DNA is a recipe for proteins.
Okay.
It's a recipe book for which proteins the body needs to produce. And with epigenetics and with those little carbon and hydrogen, those methyl groups that sits on the DNA due to epigenetics, the proteins that are produced changes. And we want to find out, is there any part that this epigenetics can possibly play in the formation of cancer cells?
Mm-hmm. So is it safe to say that cancer is an inflammatory disease? It's inflammation in the body, isn't it?
It definitely plays a role. Mm-hmm. It definitely plays a role. Okay. Zelda just touched on it. Species that don't develop cancer. And I would like to mention the example of bats. Bats live relatively long lives. They live between 30 and 40 years. And they've got a high metabolic rate. Mm. And yet the incidence of cancer is very low in bats. And they've discovered that they have different anti-inflammatory responses that can actually heal damaged cells. They also have a heightened DNA repair system and a way to eliminate cancer cells via the immune system. And also, in the end, they've got adaptations that prevents cancer growth.
Okay.
By investigating something like bats' metabolism, it might give us answers in human physiology as well.
Because that is, Zelda, Neil, that's the big issue, is that the current treatments that we have are not only killing the cancer, but they're damaging the rest of the immune system. Right?
Yes. It's we're trying to develop more and more specific treatment that specific targets the cancer cell, because we do not want to kill other cells as well. We want to specific, and that is the wonderful thing about the new treatment modalities that's coming out now. They're much more specific to the mutated cancer cell.
So would you say that the limitations of current cancer treatments and what you can have, chemotherapy, you can have radiation, and then surgery, right? Is the limitation there that we are causing damage to the good, healthy cells?
I don't think that is really the focus of chemotherapy, although it's a fact. But chemotherapy works on the principle that it kills cells while they are dividing.
Okay.
And cancer cells divide quickly. That's why a cancer can grow so fast. But in the process, it also kills other fast dividing cells in the body. That's why people lose their hair.
Okay.
And that's the challenge with current chemotherapy, to reduce side effects. And it's possible, but it is a known fact. It kills dividing cells in different stages of the division, and you can also use a combination of chemotherapy to attack the cell in more than one part of the division.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why it gives side effects mostly. And, as you've mentioned, cells of the immune system also divide quickly, so they are a target.
Mm-hmm.
But the other limitations, sorry, Carol Ann, is also we must look at the human factor. The treatment these days, it's long treatment, the side effects, it's got a huge influence on the whole family.
Yes.
You know, if a family member has cancer, they're tired, they're prone to infection, they have other side effects, the treatment regimes are long and tedious. Mm. So hopefully the new treatments that come out would have a lesser impact on the whole family of this cancer patient in the setup.
How close are we? I mean,
no.
Is it going to take a long, long time?
That's a difficult question, but if I look at the progress that's being made and the rate of development, it's just astounding.
Yeah.
It really develops fast.
It you know, if I just take a quick browse through the internet and I see on a daily basis the new research that they are discovering, different, you know, every single day there seems to be some new discovery in terms of cancer research.
That's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. There are very exciting things that are coming through. One of them is that they can do a blood test now for cancer fragments. In other words, even changed DNA that comes from cancer cells that have been damaged or partly eliminated by the immune system. And that is a detection for multi-types of cancer with one blood test, which is fantastic new breakthrough. We also have, since a few years ago, whole body scans, which can pick up lesions very early and in different parts of the body at the same time.
And does Neil, that doesn't expose you to radiation then, because then there's that whole full body scan.
It does expose the body to radiation, but the levels have been calculated, and it's not more damaging than the benefit that it provides. Definitely
okay,
not.
Then going through the airport. For example.
They can also do low-dose CTs. If there's a situation where they know that people are going to be followed up multiple times, which sometimes happens in a research situation, they can do low-dose CT scans with much less radiation.
So, you know, the message is clear. Early detection is key when it comes to this brutal disease, right? Early detection. So for women, we know I'm going to go for my monthly mammograms. Men, you know, that prostate, you need to do what you need to do. You tell me there is this wonderful new detection of the body scan. Is that available to the average man in the street? If I was to...
The multi-test, the blood test that he was talking about is not yet approved by the FDA, but I think it's not too far from going to market. It does unfortunately not eliminate or test for all types of cancer because it is limited to identifying certain proteins that's present in certain cancers. At the moment, the research that's coming out shows that it's highly specific. So it will be able to tell you, yes, you're testing positive for a cancer, and that cancer is most likely colon or most likely breast. Right. But it does not include all cancers at this stage.
What would you say are some of the biggest challenges in translating your research findings into clinical practice?
I think that we can answer on a global level, but also more specifically for South Africa. I think
cost. Cost is the one thing.
Really?
Yeah. The cost. If something comes to market, and it's especially if it's a new class of drug, it is exorbitantly expensive. Mm-hmm. I think Neil can maybe. I don't know if we've got the.
Yeah, I've got a very good example. Yes. A long-time friend and turned out to be a neighbor was diagnosed with a very rare cancer called blastic plasmocytic dendritic cell neoplasm. First time I've ever heard of it. But there is a functional cure available. Functional cure means the cancer will not be detected as long as the medication is taken. And because of our contact with pharmaceutical companies and the ability to import unregistered drugs, I made contact with a company. And they were prepared to supply it at a reduced cost to this particular patient. And it worked out to, it's a 21-day cycle, which means you have to stay on the medication every 21 days. It worked out to 3.4 million rand per cycle.
Gosh.
It's available, but who can afford that? Who can afford it?
Isn't that the tragedy? I mean, it's what happens when a country, okay, they develop, I know of a situation where Australia, there's a drug, but it's not available in another country, and somebody really wants it. I mean, it's just...
That goes two ways. Not only does it depend on the regulatory authority if a drug will be approved or not, but pharmaceutical companies will really register medication where they're likely to make a profit. It's a fact. And to register the drug for which the demand is 1-2 patients per year, it's not worth it. Yeah. So they don't even submit to SAHPRA, the South African Regulatory Authority. Yeah, it does happen.
Okay.
Caroline, there is, of course, the Section 21 application that one can go through where you apply for a medication unregistered in South Africa to be supplied on an individual basis.
Okay. That's good to know. How does a patient, how do you choose, if you are doing a clinical trial, how does a patient, how do you choose?
For our other studies, we have a database. So we have patients that show interest. We put them on a database. So for instance, they're high blood pressure, or they've got cholesterol, or they've got diabetes. And then once a study comes through, we will contact them and let them know. For our oncology, for our cancer research, we work strictly with the oncologist. So we start right at the beginning when we get an email to ask if we're interested in a specific study.
Yeah.
We will contact the oncologist at that stage and say, does he or she think that her patients or his patients can benefit? And if so, then we take it further. So we are the research unit, but we work very, very narrowly with the oncologist, and the oncologist stays the patient's primary care provider.
It's important to just also mention that we get a request to conduct a study with a protocol already worked out. A company will decide we want to investigate a new melanoma study. This is the protocol. We have input before the final protocol is accepted, but basically the study is worked out with in and exclusion criteria. And here it's important to mention, if we, for instance, know that a new drug from animal studies or early phase studies have a tendency to worsen kidney functions, the company will likely exclude people with an already impaired kidney function.
Okay. Yeah.
And we have to look at the in and exclusion criteria, and also so the treating physician, to decide which patients can benefit and which not will fit the patient that the company is looking for.
Have you, in your careers, had, can you tell us about an aha moment where it must be so challenging and exciting, though, what you do to be a part of a research, you know, company. Can you tell us about when you've had a, oh, wow, look what I've discovered? It must be so rewarding.
Yeah, that is very rewarding.
It is rewarding, yes.
It's nice to be aware of medication that will be on the market in 5 or 10 years' time, and we have the privilege of dealing with that first.
Yes.
I think for me personally, one of the most rewarding situations was a recent study in hemophiliacs, where hemophiliacs up to this point, and mostly still in South Africa, need to inject factor that they are missing directly into their veins. And they're taught to self-administer that in a vein. But this is a new compound that works through the liver, and it's an injection under the skin once a month, according to weight, sometimes once every 6 months. And the patients just stopped bleeding.
Wow.
For the duration of the study, there were 1 or 2 recorded bleeds. And initially, to qualify for the study, they had to have had 6 bleeds in 6 months, serious bleeds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was very rewarding. Maybe you can talk about
that. Hemophiliacs is actually It's a wonderful show of medical advances, because our hemophiliacs that's older, that were young children falling and bleeding into their joints, that did not have the medication, they all have severe arthritic complications from the bleeds that they've had throughout their life. And as we have patients that are younger, that's hemophiliacs, we're finding that they have a much more normal life. You can actually see it in the ward.
Yeah.
It's age-dependent how these patients are now living basically normal lives, where previously they were very disabled at early ages due to these bleeds. The other interesting things that we, of course, see, he's got some cancer stories that's fantastic.
Oh, share them. This series is about hope.
We did a study in patients with squamous cell carcinoma.
Tell us, the layman, what that is.
It's a type of skin cancer that can invade. It can invade locally, but it can also spread.
Quickly. And
yeah, it depends on factors of the patient as well as the environment. But yeah, it's a cancer that needs to be watched. It does spread. And we tested a new class of medication, an intravenous formulation on these patients. And our first patient had a 100% success rate.
Wow.
He was stopped from the study because he was cured.
Wonderful.
Most of the participants had more than 80% success rate. In other words, improvement from where they were. The study was designed for a period of 1 year to 18 months. That is the data available, the longest treatment that any of these patients have had on the study. And we've now one lady that we've requested to carry on longer. It will not only give the company more data, mm-hmm. what happens with long-term use of this new drug, but also this lady, although slowly now, still improves. She's now 80-85%.
Gosh,
cure.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
If you, as scientists, if you look to what's going on in the world and the research that's happening, you know, all across the globe, what for you are some of the most exciting stories that you read about, that, you know, research that you are not a part of, but that you go, wow, that's something to watch?
There are a number of things, Zelda, that I would like to mention. I think what we need to touch on is the involvement of artificial intelligence.
Oh, absolutely. That's what I was going to ask you, is how much of a part is it going to play? Or is it already playing?
It is.
Yes.
It is.
It must be, huh?
It's already playing. It's, you know, when you look at the amount of data that can be
analyzed
via AI and machine learning, you know,
if you feed it with the right information.
And it tends to group a new group, it identifies others, and with people or protein. And proteins have structures, and structures, you can determine, they identify each other by their structure.
Yes.
We cannot, with blood tests or the human eye or with a calculator, pick up all the different permeations that's in a blood test. And this is what AI can do for us. And that is AI that's actually telling us certain cancers we've got, the scientist has seen certain mutations being frequent or very specific to certain cancers, and AI can pick this up.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, if we can pick it up, we can use it as a potential treatment pocket. So what happens with pharmaceuticals and treatment is the treatment, whether it be for hypertension or whether it be for cancer, for chemotherapy, it needs to interact with the cell.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to at some other way connect to that cell. And that pocket, that active pharmacological pocket, needs the structure needs to be seen. If we can understand what that binding site looks like, we can create something that can attach to that binding site. And this is where AI is so brilliant in helping us. You know, the speed at which AI can do this is just
phenomenal.
It's phenomenal. Mm-hmm.
We see a trend that initially we didn't understand, especially with cancer research, where there's a second document and a process that needs to be discussed with potential participants. And that's the use of optional blood. We send blood normally to a central laboratory. It's mostly for South Africa in Europe where the blood is analyzed for safety. Look at the liver functions, the kidney functions, thyroid functions, that it doesn't change during the treatment. But also look at blood levels of the new compound, how quickly is it eliminated. And then they also look for markers. But this second process seeks consent from participants to use unused blood, especially for the development of markers, and look into things that AI can give us answers to.
Okay.
So there's a big repository of blood samples of cancer patients being built up all over that they can use for future cancer research.
You know, if we do a study and we take that kind of blood for storage in the beginning, say, for instance, 2 years down the line, a new biomarker is identified, we would like to go back and see what this treatment did to that new binding, that new biomarker. Okay. So we can actually then go back and say, this is what it was before we started treatment, this is what it was during treatment, mm-hmm. this is what it is now. Now, we don't have to do a new study to go just to go and have a look at that blood test.
Yes.
We keep that blood separate for full use mm-hmm. later on because of the speed at which things are developing at the moment.
It's something I want to ask you is, we also don't know why cancer spreads, right? Mm. Is it what causes that cell to break off and move away? Is it a binding thing? Do we just don't know?
Yeah, that's one of those questions that you said, are there any unanswered questions?
And that is one of them. We don't know why it breaks off. And
we know that there's certain cancers. In certain cancers, there are certain cells called cancer stem cells that tend to be the seeds for metastases.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, there's other cancers that don't have cancer stem cells, and they still metastasize. We also don't understand why, you know, metastases is it seeds into the bloodstream and then it goes throughout the body. Why would certain cancers specifically have a spread to the bone?
Yes.
Or specifically to the brain?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know.
Yeah.
There's another factor that is being examined at the moment, and that is the direct environment surrounding a cancer. Looking at how much inflammatory cells are there, what is the salt contents, what is there that stimulates new blood formation, because a cancer that grows needs new blood supply mm-hmm. all the time to supply it with nutrients.
Yes.
So looking at the microenvironment, the milieu of a cancer and cancer cells to determine are there any factors that can play a part. We also know that the microenvironment have an influence on stem cells, cancer stem cells, and they can stimulate the spread, the faster division, and so on. So there's focus on the mm-hmm. on the cancer and as well as the environment.
Neil, talk to us about stem cells, because we're on layman. We kind of know what stem cell, but how are stem cells being used in cancer research?
Well, if we talk about cancer stem cells, that's not something that is being used. It's actually one of the problems that we encounter. Cancer stem cells are about 100 out of 10,000 cells that seem to divide so slow that we can regard them as immortal.
Okay.
They can initiate metastases, in other words, spread. They can determine the rate of division of cancer cells.
Okay.
They seem, and they also resistant to treatment in most cases. So not all cancer have cancer stem cells, but that is a problem.
Okay.
But then the other stem cells that most people know about, that they use in blood cancers, that is in the bone marrow stem cells where we have this bone marrow transplant.
Yes, yes.
That's something completely different. Yes,
right.
That is when we basically say this patient has blood cancer and the stem cells has gone awry. They give high doses of chemotherapy, so they pretty much blow out the patient's population and then replace it with a healthy individual stem cell. So that's a completely different to the cancer stem cells.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Neil, you talked about the environment around the cancer. Am I correct or incorrect in saying this? I do believe this, maybe I'm wrong, but the healthier you are going in to a cancer journey, the better your chances of survival. Does that have anything to do with when you talked about inflammatory cells around, like, in terms of lifestyle?
It definitely plays a part. Lifestyle does play a part. I am reluctant to say, because of that, if you change your lifestyle, it might have a direct influence. I'm thinking of people who suddenly cut out all sugar because cancer cells need sugar. They are fast dividing and they need energy. I don't necessarily agree with that, mostly because often it's too late to change that.
Yeah.
But I think it links to the epigenetics that Zelda mentioned yesterday, that the environment, how healthy you are, your general state of health, has an influence on the epigenetics, and that can lead to to cancer development or not.
Okay. Future innovations? What are we looking at in the future? We want to hear that there's a cure around the corner.
The exciting things, obviously, is the test, the multi-cancer test, because early detection is the holy grail.
Yes.
That is the holy grail. But then your personalized medicine, where some of these are already available. They're talking about cancer vaccines. Now, this is not a vaccine like we understand a vaccine. We understand a vaccine, we give the baby a vaccine, and that prevents him from getting the disease. Cancer vaccine is using the technology of a vaccine to target a specific cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can know, like I said just now, if we can understand the mutations and we can see them and we can know this is what the mutation for your colon cancer looks like, we can actually make a vaccine for your cancer. And then your own immune systems can actually fight that.
Yes.
We talked just earlier, you mentioned that the current treatment modalities are basically chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and surgery. But I think it's important for everybody also listening, that there are new treatment modalities which are really very exciting. The first one is immunotherapy.
Yes, I've heard of this. Yes,
it uses the body's own immune system to fight cancer. And I always like to compare it to Harry Potter and his invisibility cloak.
Mm.
As soon as he put this cloak over him, nobody could see him. And that's what cancer cells do. They secrete chemicals which make them invisible to the immune system.
Okay.
With especially the checkpoint inhibitors, and we've done two studies on checkpoint inhibitors, they remove the cloak so that the immune system can recognize the cancer cells, and then the immune system destroys the cancer cells.
Yeah.
And that's what we had the 100% success rate with the squamous cell carcinoma is on the immune checkpoint inhibitors. There's also targeted therapy, as Zelda mentioned. Here, they can identify a protein that they want a specific medication to bind to, and they make a lab-manufactured molecule that will attach specifically to that marker that I've identified. If I don't have the markers, it's useless giving me the therapy, but Zelda might have it, and that's why it's more personalized medication that is coming through. We can also have a combination of either a immunotherapy or a vaccine with cancer chemotherapy, where it will attach then to a specific cell with a receptor that I've identified, and the chemotherapy can either kill the cell or make it available to the immune system. So combinations of that are available. I've also read about a new treatment called targeted osmotic lytic therapy. And here they destroy cancer cells. Here they destroy cancer cells by exposing a person to a certain energy field which opens sodium cells on the surface of the cells. Sodium then flows into the cell swells and breaks in the end.
Gosh.
It's very experimental, but it's far less invasive than using needle and chemotherapy.
Yes.
And then also we've encountered recently repurposing of existing medication. That's being examined, something like Celebrex, which is an anti-inflammatory drug, and we talked earlier that inflammation does play a part in cancer development, using Celebrex to slow down the process.
Wow.
We've heard about the use of ivermectin, which is a veterinary medication.
That is being really touted as a...
Absolutely. Now, there's no conclusive proof, but it is being investigated.
Is it?
Because
okay.
it will be much cheaper.
Yes.
Same with mebendazole, which is
I've heard of that as
anti-helminthic
well.
Or anti-worm medication. And these repurposing of existing medications might also in the future unlock something.
If they are cheap, will they see the light of day?
They are much cheaper than...
Yeah, they won't. They'll always be adjuvant. So they'll be added on treatment.
Yes.
It will be part of a treatment regime. And then, of course, the other thing that is the CAR T cells, which is also specialized. It's a personalized type of treatment where you will take a patient's cancer, you will look at the cancer and determine the specific binding sites and mutations. Okay. You take the patient's own T cell and teach them that that is the cancer, and then put the T cell back in the patient so that the patient's own immune system can be triggered to actually fight the cancer.
Is a T cell the same as a killer cell?
You get killer T cells.
Yeah.
Is that what you call, is it a killer T cell?
Okay. T cells, there are different variations and forms of T cells, but killer cells is a T cell. Yeah.
While I have you, I just we covered in one of the episodes with a dietitian, Mary Ann Victor, that obesity is kind of a no-no for cancer, that it really is one of the lifestyle diseases that you need to get a handle on for cancer, to prevent cancer. Is Ozempic something that they say it's going to be a new weight loss drug, that people are not going to be using it anymore for diabetes? We know already they are, but it's not marketed just for that. Is that are we going to see that?
Yeah, look, Ozempic is part of a class called the GLP-1 and agonists. We've had fantastic studies with wonderful success. And I think the first thing that must go out there is that obesity is a disease such as hypertension, such as diabetes. It is a lifestyle disease. It is not because people are lazy and eat too much. Mm-hmm. I think that is something that must be educated out to the people. Obviously, obesity is an inflammatory process. It's an inflammatory disease. And, things like the GLP-1s are very effective in treating obesity. Mm-hmm. Down the line, there will be some medications coming out that will be combinations of GLP-1 and other medications. There's double, there's dual agonists or antagonists, and there's triple antagonists coming onto the market. Triple agonists actually coming onto the market. That shows a lot of promise. So I think the first and the most important lesson is to know that obesity is something that needs to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that you go and you tell your patients go home and do some exercise.
Don't have that extra role.
Yes. It's more than that. It needs to be treated.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's an inflammatory process. It leads to other diseases, of which cancer could very well be one of them.
Yeah. Okay. doctors. Okay, I want to. How do you become? You have my utmost respect. How do you become a research scientist? What?
There's a degree locally or in South Africa as well as internationally. There are degrees focusing on research. Focusing on research, things like each area or each region has very specific rules, regulations, mm-hmm. and laws. European Union, the FDA in America, yes. and South Africa. Knowing what the processes are of drug development and so on. So there are degrees in clinical research, which we've both done through the Dublin University, but it's also available locally.
Okay.
And yeah, I think just a keen interest on
curious
new
minds.
Developments.
Yeah. I want to ask you quickly about China. Now they have quite a high incidence of cancer because of the pollution. Don't they? Would you say that there is a race across the globe to find a cancer cure? That there's, whoever's going to find a wonder drug.
Well, obviously, everybody wants to find the wonder drug, because if you're first to market, first in
then
class,
yes,
from a financial, economical point of view, it's good for you. So it's also that if you look at the projections of where the money is going to be spent in mm-hmm. pharmacological development in the next 5 years, then oncology or cancer research is definitely
right
ahead
up there.
It's ahead of the pack,
Neil Zelder, is there anything that we haven't covered in closing? Any key?
The only thing that I want to say is, early detection, we've said it before, early detection is the way to go. And you go to your GP. Go to your GP and ask them, this is my family history, this is my history.
Yes.
Am I at high risk of any cancers? And then make sure that you're educated, make sure that you know, and that make sure that you have regular follow-ups so that you can find if there is anything and find it at an early mm-hmm. stage, because that's definitely the only and biggest factor to look at what your prognosis is how early the diagnosis
yes.
is made.
Yeah.
At artificial intelligence can look at your genetic makeup, very subtle changes in blood results, and then predict your success with certain treatments.
Gosh, yeah.
And the other thing that I just wanted to mention in terms of early detection, artificial intelligence is also now used to help with the interpretation of things like scans. Artificial intelligence can notice minute differences that the human eye
cannot detect.
Wow. So that's also used there. Mm-hmm. And I cannot agree more with Zelda. Make your GP your friend, and that's your first point of contact mm-hmm. for cancer.
Mm-hmm. Doctors Neil Malan and Dr. Zelda Pint, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your knowledge with us. We so appreciate it. Any resources you could maybe recommend?
Your GP?
Your GP.
Your GP. We do not like Dr. Google.
That is a resource, but it's not always reliable. And I think without any background knowledge of an inclination of what is really out there and available, it's a difficult field. Mm-hmm. I think your GP is the best contact.
Yeah.
In our next episode, I am joined by plastic surgeon Dr. Ranelle Gower and two-time breast cancer survivor Jill Foley. Breast cancer is the most common cancer worldwide among women, and it is estimated that one in every 27 women in South Africa is at risk of being diagnosed during their lifetime. The Big C podcast series is proudly brought to you by Algo FM. Till next time, take care.